And hello to all of you out there in podcast world. This is the Front Row Network. I'm your host, Brandon Davis, and this is our monthly edition of Front Row Classics. We are back after quite a lengthy hiatus. I'm still sorry about that, but we're back and we're ready to roll. And I have two great guests with me. I have returning to classics after a while, our editor-in-chief, Jeremy.
You know, I feel like with that title, I should probably be on this show a lot more. I mean, like, it seems like a prestigious thing, right? It seems like I should know a little bit about, like, good movies, but I'm too busy slocking it with Lou on Guilty Pleasures. That's what I'm doing nowadays.
Well, Lou makes it a fun place to be, at least.
He really does. He really does. Go and listen to our Wild Wild West episode, which I lobbied Brandon to be on Classics, but, yeah, what are you going to do?
We can talk about the 60s TV show sometime.
There you go. You know?
And also joining us on the front row actually for the first time is Eric Flick. Hi, Eric.
Hi.
How you doing?
Thank you for having me. Yeah, right. This is exciting. I'm excited to do this for the first time.
Yeah, well, Jeremy messaged me, it was about a month ago, saying, hey, I need to connect you with this guy. He's just as big a fan of classics as you are. So.
I don't know if that's 100% true. You know, is there a person as big a fan of classic movies as you? But yeah, I enjoy all the classic films, and I'm sure I'm preparing myself for a question that's going to be coming up here. So
that's right.
Fire away.
And Craig will be so proud of you for remembering Jeremy, because I probably wouldn't have.
I usually don't. It's usually you that remembers.
I know. So, Eric, anybody who comes into the front row for the first time, we ask them the same question. What's your favorite movie?
Yeah, and I'm going to get flack for this because I listened to your episode on Citizen Kane, but that is my number one favorite movie.
It's not a bad choice.
Comparing it to Eating Your Vegetables, though, I was like, oh, wow. The minute that movie came on, I got super excited.
I did, too.
And so that for me is top to bottom, a great movie. It's still groundbreaking today in what it does. So that to me is the sign of a great movie and my absolute all-time favorite.
You know what I love about this guy already? He's already – it's his first appearance, and he's already plugging new, like, old episodes of the show. He is a natural.
That one. It's a good one.
Yeah, he's a natural. No, but I agree with you, Eric. That is, I think, one of the best film discussions we've ever had on the front row.
It really is. Well, and, you know, we're discussing Wells, but today we're going to be discussing another giant of movie history, Hitchcock.
That Hitchcock guy.
Yeah, he's pretty good.
What a weirdo.
We're going to be talking about really what I think probably the best movie that we haven't talked about yet on Classics. Mm-hmm. We're talking Vertigo, and it's a movie that I've loved for a long time. There's something so unique about it in the Hitchcock canon. Even it's not like most other Hitchcock movies. It's so personal. Yeah. Eric, we'll start with you though. We'll talk about first impressions. What were your first impressions the first time you saw Vertigo?
The first time I saw Vertigo, and it was probably back in the mid '90s, and I'd seen Hitchcock films. And I think the statement that you made, that it stands out even among his group of works, is right on the money. It plays out more like a foreign film, which makes sense. It's based off of a French novel, and it tackles a lot of different themes, which I'm sure that we'll get into, but way more than you see in a lot of his other films. And I was thinking about this film, and when I rewatched it, I'm not even sure what genre you would put this film in.
Yeah.
Kind of, it's undefinable that way.
It's because it's not really a murder mystery. It's not really film noir. It's not really, but it kind of fits in all those boxes.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's a bit of romance to it too. And it's a tragedy as well. So it's a whole lot of things.
Right. Jeremy, what were your first impressions?
Yeah, like when we, you know, most of the time when I see these movies for the first time, it's when Brandon and I watched the AFI's Top 100 in college. We literally watched all 100. And that was the first time I saw this movie. And you're right. It's like I'd seen – you'd shown me Hitchcock before – But this one just felt different, you know, because you're right. Like, there's not the easy suspense that you get from, like, a Rear Window or a Rope or a Dial In for Murder or something like that. Those are what you would typically expect with a Hitchcock movie. But this one, you're right. There's so many layers on it. There's so many layers that are on top of more layers in this movie, which is why I'm so excited to discuss it. But, you know, obviously we're probably going to get into that iconic shot in the hotel room. That always stands out to me. But also just, I think, the more I watch this movie, the more I get an appreciation for the performers in it, specifically Stuart and Novak. Stuart, because it's kind of different than what he's been doing in his career up until this point, which I'll explain more later. But also just Kim Novak, because as you know, Hitchcock wasn't always the easiest on his leading ladies. And I think that she handles this role just so well, and handles that prototypical Hitchcock leading woman in kind of, I think, the best way I've seen from any of his leading ladies.
Yeah, it's such a personal movie. You know, Hitchcock movies, you know, when we talked about North by Northwest and I said, you know, how fun this is, I wouldn't categorize this as a fun movie.
But it's one that
you can't get out of your head after you've seen it.
Yeah.
Just because I don't know. And this is one of those movies that I love watching with people who've never seen it before, because I love watching how they react, especially toward the end. Because it's not at all what it's so layered that it's a totally different movie the second time you watch it than the first time you watch it.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
When you know what everything is going on. I'm excited to dig into this. As you mentioned, Eric, it was based off of a French novel, and you know, Hitchcock really loved San Francisco, and he wanted to set a murder mystery in San Francisco. Of course, I don't think he banked on it getting as personal as this movie becomes, but San Francisco is almost just as much of a character in this movie as anything. And I've never seen a city shot more beautifully than what he does in this movie. It's another character. It really is.
Absolutely. And how fitting for a movie entitled Vertigo that it's that you got the vistas and the skyscape that you have in a city like San Francisco. And I thought about this too on my most recent rewatch. You really couldn't pick this movie up and put it anywhere else. You know, they visit a Spanish mission. They go see the Sequoia trees. All of those things are iconic to the city of San Francisco and the surrounding areas. So it was a really smart choice to set it there, and it really creates a beautiful backdrop for everything that's going on as well.
Yeah, every scene is almost like I don't think I've ever seen color the way that Hitchcock incorporates color in this movie. It's all so purposeful, and it's just so dark things are happening, and yet it's so beautiful to look at.
Yes.
It really is something. Well, let's dig in. First of all, let's just talk about the cast of this movie. Very small cast. Really only two major characters, and really maybe two or three other smaller supporting characters. But I think, and we've talked about Jimmy Stewart a lot on this podcast, but I think George Bailey aside, I think this is his best performance. I don't think he's ever given a better, he's never shown the range of what he can do more than what he does in this movie, than what he does to Scotty Ferguson. Jeremy?
Yeah, that's, you know, it was, I was watching a show recently where they showed a clip of him in Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, the climactic scene where he's near the end of his filibuster and that. And, you know, I came to the realization that, you know, when I think of Jimmy Stewart, I think of a boisterous performance. You know what I mean? I think of George Bailey running down the street. I think of Jefferson Smith, you know, standing there defiantly with all the letters. You know, I think of him yelling at Westerners in Liberty Valance and stuff. You know, like I think of him as an energetic personality. And then you have this performance, which is so calculating and so quiet. You know, it was kind of the way I felt about Brad Pitt's performance in Benjamin Button the first time I saw it, where everything is a very deliberate choice. And not that, you know, that I put them on the same plane, but it just gave me the same feeling of, here's an actor that has literally already gotten his legend status by the time he made this movie. And yet here he is diving into some deeply psychological waters with a director that's known to get that out of you, which he's already worked with before. But this is a character that is so... I think you can imprint any kind of vice, any kind of mental hang-up that you would have in life, and you can see it in this character. And that's kind of what I always come back to with this, is that this is Jimmy Stewart showing his really calculating and really deliberate side as an actor, as opposed to just the raw energy he brought to a lot of other roles that he did in his career.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's a great take on it. I mean... You could very much compare this to It's a Wonderful Life, where you have two characters who both have to confront death. And you look at the choices that he makes in Vertigo, and it's a much darker take on it, and it's a much more nuanced take on it. And you can also compare this to Rear Window. Yeah. And the... You're absolutely right. Hitchcock got so much more, needed to get so much more out of him for Vertigo than he did for Rear Window. Rear Window, he just had to be a paranoid guy who is also a hero at heart.
Yeah.
This takes so much more range. Mm-hmm. And you're right. There's just about every aspect of human psychology that you can throw into this guy who's a detective, but he's also broken. Mm. He's got fears. He can't. His love life is in shambles. He goes to an asylum for a time being. I mean, just anything that could happen to this guy, it happens. And Jimmy Stewart just nails it in every scene.
Yeah,
there's something about Jimmy Stewart and his work with Hitchcock where, with more than any other director he ever worked with, Jimmy Stewart felt comfortable sometimes being unlikable when he was under Hitchcock's thumb. It's hinted at a little in Rear Window, just the way he treats Grace Kelly every once in a while. You're like, man, this guy can really be a jerk sometimes.
Which we discussed at length.
but here, and even though toward the end, and you know he's been played, and you know he's been psychologically tortured, he's not aware of that, and some of the things he is doing to Judy, who he's thinking at the time, is really unredeemable in
messed
some
up.
Ways.
Let's just call it what it is.
He's basically telling another human being, "You're not good enough. Please, you know, become this other person." And,
no, but you're right. Like Eric, yeah. I love what you say. Broken. That is the perfect way to put it, because there are many unlikable things about Scotty, but he is still our kind of de facto hero. He's not quite like the anti-hero that like a Nicholson in Chinatown is, but like he still does have that view of sympathy, because we do get to go along with his brokenness on that journey.
Oh, and it's not only mental, he's physically got a back problem.
Yeah.
And, you know, he carries a cane around for a portion of the movie, and he is and he's certainly flawed, but incredibly sympathetic. You can almost see yourself, and one of the other themes that really bubbles up in this movie is the theme of falling. He's falling all the time in this movie.
Right.
And he's falling in love. And even when he's telling her, "I need you to do these things," it's because of a compulsion that he doesn't even really have control over at that point.
No. And one of the things that I find so interesting is I think, and this isn't a new idea by any means, but I think more than any other character, I think Hitchcock probably put more of himself into the Scotty Ferguson character.
I would think so.
Because I think because in many ways the character of Scotty Ferguson is impotent because of his, you know, because of his psychological hang-ups. And I think Hitchcock kind of always felt, you know, he longed to be part of something that he could never be part of. He had to sort of stand and watch it from behind. That's why he becomes so obsessive with his films and his movie making. And, you know, he becomes obsessive with his leading ladies. And that's exactly what Scotty does with Madeline in this movie. And so it's really, really fascinating, because I think you're getting an absolute perfect view into the psyche of Alfred Hitchcock and the character of Scotty.
Absolutely. And he's taking this woman and making her into the Alfred Hitchcock blonde.
Yeah, he is.
that he casts in every one of his movies. And it's incredibly fitting in this movie and just really, really well done. And even the shots, as the first time that Jimmy Stewart sees the Madeline character, they're always shots from over his shoulder or distant shots, and yeah. He is observing her from far away. And it's almost like how you'd picture Hitchcock casting a leading lady. He would right. He would watch her walking around a movie set somewhere from far away before he worked up the nerve to say, okay, you're in the picture.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, Jimmy Stewart is such an interesting actor to watch think. I mean, and you talked about it, Eric, with it being sort of like a foreign film. There's about 20 minutes of silence toward the beginning of the movie where he's just yes. following her around.
Yeah.
And yet you're so into it by watching just Jimmy Stewart driving around and thinking.
Yeah. I mean, isn't that the ultimate sign of a great actor where, like, they can just arrest you with a look and stuff. And you're right. Like, it seems so strange that in a movie this obsessive and this this visually stunning that he does give you all of that time at the very beginning of the film. Like, we've established where we are and everything, but then he's like, okay, and now we're going to be silent for a while. And I feel like that's really where the movie kind of gets its mojo from, is that, you know, this is about a lot more than just a murder mystery, because the murder mystery fades away so quickly in the scheme of this story
yeah.
that it's almost like an afterthought every single time you think about this. You think about Madeline and Judy and Scotty. You don't think about, you know, the wife that's killed here. You don't think about the husband that sets him up at all. It's like you have to, like, force yourself to think about that aspect of this movie.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And as we can segue now, though, into talking about Kim Novak as yes, Madeline please. And Judy. It's interesting when you read, like, the original reviews of the movie. Her performance was criticized. She was called wooden, and she really kind of took a beating. And I think, in retrospect now, of course, 50 years later, she's perfectly, you know, following, you know, I'm sure what Hitchcock wanted her to do, because this is a woman who's totally conflicted, and she would sort of walk through the world in a daze the way that Judy and Madeline does. You know, just absolutely just interesting to watch. And you mentioned, Jeremy, about Hitchcock and his leading ladies. When you hear Kim Novak in interviews, she had a wonderful experience with Hitchcock. You know, she's one of the ones who had perfectly great things to say. She said this was one of her happiest movie making experiences. Yeah. And I think probably because she was able to show her range in this movie a little more than she was used to other times when she was on film.
Yeah, definitely read up on some of the other ones, kids, because there's not a lot of great experiences of leading ladies with Alfred Hitchcock.
No.
But yeah, I think that's indicative of what you said about how this is a different kind of Hitchcock film, about how this one isn't the typical beats. Like, you know, he was obviously so obsessive with Janet Leigh in Psycho. He obviously put Tippi Hedren through so many ringers in The Birds. But, you know, here we have and I can't take credit for this point of view. It's actually from my favorite film reviewer of all time, Roger Ebert. But he said an observation that always stuck out with me in this movie, which is that he said, and let me make sure I try and get this right. But he says, like, in this movie, from the second we are let in on the kind of the trickery of this movie, which is that Scotty is being set up and everything, from the second we learn that, he says the movie is equally about Judy and Madeline's pain as well as Scotty's from that point on. Mm-hmm. And, you know, nowhere in this is, like, you know, we always get to see that, you know, she is, as you say, kind of a willing enabler of Scotty's obsession here. You know, there's in that climactic shot in the hotel room, he does that whole thing about showing both of their faces and how they're both having two different emotions around the same thing at the same time. She wants to please Scotty. She's shifted her allegiance to him in a way, and that in a way traps her. And you're right, it gets to, like, Kim Novak gets to show so much range through the second half of this movie in how she gets transformed and how she willingly goes along with it, and that's something that always stuck out to me and why I think this performance is one of the more underrated of all time.
And I love what you called her a willing enabler, because you forget by the second half of this movie, you begin to sympathize with her so much. And I agree with that take, that this movie becomes equally about her and how broken she is as well, and how she's constantly falling. You forget that she's an accessory to murder.
Yeah.
She already helped a man murder and cover up the murder of his wife. And yet somehow she becomes as sympathetic. And she's becoming manipulated by Scotty. But at the same time, you want to see her be happy.
Yeah.
Yeah, she there's something so and you can just see it, the pain in her eyes. Even, like I said, when you go back and watch it a second time and it becomes a different movie and you know what the secret is, it becomes, and you watch it from Judy's point of view, the whole movie. It's really, really interesting. And you can see little moments, little subtle moments where you feel like once you know the secret, oh, she's going to break and she's going to tell him at one point, you know, because she really, really loves him. But, it's when you put yourself in her shoes, there's just as much pain going on as there is in Scotty's point of view.
So why do you guys think that is, though? Why do you think she doesn't just come right out and tell him? I mean, that would clearly be the way to actually preserve any semblance of this relationship, wouldn't it?
And I've got a thought on that. And I think this goes even deeper into the Alfred Hitchcock's I think he was a fan of psychology and of Freud and a lot of the what makes the sexuality between men and women really work.
Right.
And there's a piece of her that feels that in order to be loved, in order to be worthy of the love from Scotty, she thinks of herself as a bad person as well. She's going to go along with the ruse and let her self be transformed by him. And only then, when that fully happens, she has a great line where she's fully back in the Madeline attire. She's finally dyed her hair and done it up the way that he's asked her to do it. And she comes out and she says, "I've finally really got you, don't I, Scotty?" I mean, it's, and he's at that point realized who she is because she has put the necklace on, but that's also her finally realizing that by doing that, by letting herself be manipulated, she could actually click into those feelings that she had for him.
Yeah. So is there also, like, yeah, and there's also kind of a in with that, like, that this is the only way she is going to feel loved by him, that he's been broken to the point where he can't get past this. And that she has to do this because this is the only way she can have him.
And by that point, she's willing to do that. She I mean, because she could very well, once she discover, you know, once he discovers her alter ego and finds out, you know, she's wanting to skip town, but something just holds her there. And, you know, she says, okay, I love this man enough and I'm willing to give into his obsessions and become his obsession. Which, is Freudian in another way.
just a little bit.
And she has one of the most iconic looks of any character in any movie. And, you know, and of course, I'm no expert in terms of, you know, the fashion designers of the time. But, you know, the way Edith Head, you know, just, created that gray suit and that, you know, and the tightly wound blonde hair, you know, it's such a stark look. You know, you can't help but be mesmerized by her yourself in the audience because there's no one who looks like that.
No.
And the eyebrows very much made up in a way to be very specific and very iconic. One of the things you mentioned there was the hairstyle. And on this last viewing of this movie, I noticed that is one of the recurring symbols that you see throughout the movie. So the opening shot, you see Jimmy Stewart looking down and everything sort of looks like a spiral. And then throughout the movie, we've got the sort of animated sequences of the spiral. And it's no accident that both the hairstyle in the painting and the hairstyle that she adopts has this spiral to it as well.
And it's so interesting.
Another little thing that just makes this a masterful piece of cinema.
Yeah, and it's so interesting to me. We spend so much time invested into the story and the history of Carlotta Valdez, and it's the biggest MacGuffin Hitchcock
ever created. Talk about a MacGuffin, man.
You spend the whole first half of the movie of him figuring out this story was all made up, and we'll get to Gavin Elster in a second and what a sicko he is.
Yeah, but, I think that's something that when you showed this to Sarah, she was just like, after the viewing, she was just like, well, wait, why did we like spend all that time on that storyline?
Yeah, but I mean, it really, and it's fascinating because when you first watch the movie, you're like, wow, this is kind of an interesting paranormal thing going on here. And then, of course, you know, when you watch it the second time, as I said, it takes on a totally different meaning. But yeah, I mean, it's fascinating on so many different levels. So let's we'll get to favorite scenes after this in a second, but one more, another character I want to talk about, the character of Midge, who always fascinates me.
Yeah.
She serves so many different purposes in this movie. She's kind of the Greek chorus sometimes, and yet she instigates other times, and she's always poking. In certain ways. And I think Barbara Bel Geddes is such a great actress that she really brings what could have been such a throwaway part. She brings great weight and great depth to it. Eric, what do you think the role of Midge serves in the movie?
Oh, boy. So there's a couple of different things, certainly, that Midge does. And part of it is exposition. I mean, the scenes with her and Jimmy Stewart just working out what's going on in the plot. But then they also have this, you know, this very brief mention that they couldn't get it worked out. You know, they had been engaged at some point in the past. And, you know, whether he was physically impotent or not, you can certainly see from that the Scotty character is emotionally impotent. And you can see that she still has feelings for him. But the other strange thing that she does is sort of serves this mother figure to him. The way she treats him, the way she touches him. And in fact, she even has a line at one point says, you know, don't worry, mother's here. I'm going to take care of it, or something along those lines, which is to me more of some hang up that Hitchcock had that he wanted to put out there. Mom issues that he wanted to explore a little bit. So I don't know how deep you want to get into that, but that's certainly there. It's an underpinning of the interactions that those two have.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's not a typical like Girl Friday type of thing, but there's also that flavor like built into it. But yeah, it's a lot more. In a way, she's kind of like has that little obsession with him too. You're right; like she can't let him go, in that certain way.
Right.
And she wants to be around him, even no matter how that is. Even though they're both past that supposedly, but so in a way, that's another commentary on the obsession angle that this movie's going after, I think.
Yeah, and
she's kind of his. She's kind of his safety net too. Whenever he literally, falls off a cliff at some point, she's always there to catch him. Whenever his obsessions get too much, she's there for him when he first has to retire from the force early. She's there for him when he goes insane. And then when you read the history of this movie, there was a scene that was supposed to be tacked on to the end after the ending that we see in the movie today, where he goes back to Midge's apartment and basically doesn't say anything, just sits down comatose and she pours him a drink and that's the end. So she's always kind of, and it's interesting because she seems content with being sort of, never his first choice, but always the safe choice for him to go back to.
Right.
I just love her. She also has a sense of mischief and a sense of just, like I said, poking at him, when she does that painting of her head put on Carlotta's body and everything.
Which certainly blows up in her face, but the you can tell that the heart is there, and she does it with a warmth that that Barbara Bel Geddes really puts through.
She does.
Yeah, and really the only sense of sunshine we get in the whole movie. I mean, the only attempts at comedy to break up all the tension in the movie.
Mm-hmm. You know, yeah, and I love, you know, the conversation where they're talking about the brassiere at the beginning, you know, and he's really uncomfortable talking about that.
Yeah.
But, there's just so many great moments with her. And then, really, the other major character is Gavin Elster, who you don't see a whole lot, but, of course, he permeates.
This guy,
the story played by Tom Helmore. I love that first scene between him and Jimmy Stewart in his office when he really makes you feel for him, you know, poor guy and his wife is, you know, about to go over the edge. And then you realize just more and more, man, what a diabolical person to plan every detail of this.
You know what? I see what you did there, Brandon. Go over the edge.
Go over the edge.
Oh, man, poor Mrs. Elster. No, you're right. Like, it's absolutely a great bait and switch, and it's because he does play it so likable that you don't suspect it, you know? I mean, again, it is kind of sad that this side of the movie gets lost in the more, you know, obviously high art versions of aspects of this movie, but he does play it great. And you know, the switch off and the twist is genuinely surprising the first time you see it. And it is actually a very, very dastardly, very well thought out plan. But as per always, man, you can't plan for love.
And how does he do that? We get fooled. All the signs are there that this guy is a bad guy. But again, it's played so well, and the way the story unfolds and the way it's constructed, even after viewing it this time, you get fooled a little bit that this guy has some pure motives and is genuinely concerned that maybe his wife is being possessed by a ghost, and you. Then think of yourself as ridiculous after you realize what he's done. But maybe it's that ridiculousness that makes it all that more plausible. You know, it's sometimes the bigger the whopper, the more believable it is to some people.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, there's so much detail about Carlotta Valdez's life. You're like, who would spend their spare time making all this up?
Yeah.
But, it's really, really amazing. And even the last time you see Elster after the little hearing that they have to see, you know, if Scotty was, you know, could have done anything, you know, in preventing, you know, Madeline's death the first time around. You know, he's very supportive and, you know, not knowing, of course, at the time he's about to skim the country.
How dastardly is that scene, like, after the fact, after you know it? Like, he is so sympathetic towards him. He's like, oh, it's okay. You couldn't have done anything. Like, screw you, man. Wow. It takes a certain kind of dastardly personality to do that.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And yeah, really, you think about Hitchcock's movies, though, and we've talked about these four people, and really, he makes these movies with very small casts most of the time, and really, it revolves around these four people. And it's really told in such a tight way. Let's talk about favorite scenes and sequences. There's so many to talk about, but Eric, we'll start with you. Just throw out one. What's one of your favorites?
Sure. I mean, one of the great things about this movie and why it's so hard to put it into a genre is the very opening scene is an action sequence.
Yeah.
And you're jumping from rooftop to rooftop, and then you have that effect, which is really just a camera on a dolly cart or something like that.
Yeah.
But you quickly get to see the vertigo effect that Hitchcock wanted to throw. And I can only imagine what that would have looked like to audiences on the big screen in 1978.
Absolutely.
You know, and it probably was vertigo inducing. If you saw that, you probably were like, well, that's going to make me a little bit dizzy.
Yeah, the people in the balcony were feeling some stuff in this movie, man.
Yeah, absolutely. But then, and there's not only is that a jarring effect, you have the genuine fear that Jimmy Stewart plays with, and then you see a man tumble to his death. And so you have a very tight, how long is that? 2-3 minute sequence that really sets the stage for what's going to happen to this character in the rest of the movie, and how that event in his life is going to affect him. So a masterful way to start off this particular movie.
Yeah. And you know, the only thing I can really think Hitchcock wise that compares to it is like the beginning of Rope, You know, for the obvious reason, but you're right. Like Hitchcock doesn't normally just start just, you know, pedal to the metal, gas full on, you know, like usually he's very methodical about how he sets up his story, but you're right, right here. He just drops you right in and hey, everyone catch up with me.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and then, like I said, it follows, you know, you have that scene with him and Midge, but then him and Elster, and then it's 20 minutes of him following Madeline around. But I think that whole sequence, I don't think any other filmmaker that I know of has really mastered what it's like to be in a dream almost. It's so dreamlike, the way that you feel like you're Jimmy Stewart and the way he's using the filters and everything, like when he's following her in the cemetery.
Yeah.
I'm like, this is, so, you know, it feels so dreamlike. It doesn't seem real.
Yeah.
It doesn't seem real.
No, you're absolutely right. And just the way that, like I said, it's a testament to how well this film is made that keeps your attention for that long, even also in modern day, you know, with, you know, the guise of movie making of how it's gone, you know, there's always that sheen of like, oh, it's shot with an old camera and everything, but it still arrests your attention for the entirety of that 20 minutes.
Mm-hmm. Jeremy, what's one of your favorite scenes?
Well, I'll save the hotel room for all of us here afterward. But
thank you.
Yeah, because that, I mean, there's way too much to dive into with that one. but honestly, the end sequence of this movie, man, like for as fast as it begins, man, it ends with a bang, you know, and God, I just hear what I did there. It's like, you know, when his obsession really starts turning into madness there at the end, and you just like, oh my God, you know, like you just get so fearful for Judy that, you know, again, this is a mistress of a man that helped facilitate the man's wife's murder, and yet you're still sitting there like, no, 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 like I want her to get away, I want her to be happy, and yet, you know, it's because Jimmy Stewart has literally, or Scotty, I don't play that, but it's because Scotty is so fractured now. He's in on the con, he's there, and he just, like, the way he obsessively keeps pulling her up that clock tower, it's just so unnerving the way that unfolds. You can see where it's going, but yet you're still hoping that it doesn't quite go where it does. Mm-hmm.
There's so many questions that go along with it, too. What's going to happen? What's he going to do when they get up there? Can he even make it up the clock tower? So that's so suspenseful in all those different ways.
And my biggest question is, who does she think that nun is? She's so terrified of that figure coming at her.
Yeah.
You know, to make her, you know, get so close to the edge that she falls off. And the great thing, Hitchcock doesn't answer any of those questions.
Yeah.
No.
In a movie like this, Hitchcock's just like, wonder, people, wonder.
There's so much going on, and then all of a sudden, bam, it's over.
Yeah.
It's just,
That's kind of like the ultimate, also, like, I don't know. I always just kind of think that Hitchcock likes to be like, oh, I've got you, I got you, I got you. Okay, suffer. You know, like, it's like a Conrad Birdie situation here. You know, like, he's got us in the palm of his hand, and then right there, we get a resolution that's good enough for us because we're playing with, you know, philosophical problems in this movie, so we're already in that space. But then you're right, it just like kablam, like we're done, and you know, you're just kind of left there like, whoa, wait, and it's a brilliant stroke, really, I think.
But it's also, it mirrors that first scene so well that you accept it, that you're like, oh wow, he brought it full circle, so that's an acceptable ending to this movie.
I agree.
And for 1958, for them to accomplish what they did camera wise with them circling up in that dolly shot, which they used a miniature apparently, and they sped up the film and then reversed it to make those vertigo type shots, is just, 'cause you do feel nauseous.
Oh yeah, I mean, like, am I alone? And like every time I see those shots, I'm just like, nope, I gotta look away a little bit.
And then on top of it, you have Bernard Herrmann's amazing score that just swirls around and around and around. And that's the other big star of the movie, Bernard Herrmann's score, I think.
Absolutely.
Bernard Herrmann's score should always be the star of a movie, man.
But, yeah, just absolutely amazing. I also love the sequences where he's just, you know, taking Judy to all of the – not Judy, where he's taking Madeline to all these places, you know, where she thinks Carlotta has possessed her. Like, I love that scene in the, you know, in the Sequoia Forest.
Yeah.
You know, and you know, just, you know, where he's asking her, you know, when were you here before? And, and it's, there's just such mystery. And again, it's dreamlike. It's, and there's so much, especially when you watch it on multiple viewings, there's so much going on in terms of his story and her story. And it's just layered. It's absolutely amazing.
Yeah. Because, go ahead, Eric.
Go ahead. Well, I was going to say, particularly that sequence in the Sequoia Forest where he gives her the scientific name of the tree, and it's something like Evergreen Life or Life Everlasting or something like that. You begin to realize that, first of all, green plays a very important role throughout the movie, and we'll get to that again in a little bit. But he's also asking these life or death questions because he's looking for the answers, and he's asking those of her, not just because he's been hired to do this job and find out if she really is truly possessed, but because he's grappling with these life and death questions of himself all the time.
Yeah.
That's just another way that the subtle themes permeate this movie.
Yeah. And just also just with that sequence is like, that's really the first time you see the slow, willful self-deception a little bit on his part as well.
Yeah.
Where, you know, we're dealing with someone who thinks she's being possessed by, you know, a long dead person. And yet he, even though he is a hyperlogical detective of sorts, like, you know, he still is kind of, even though he's got that twinge of cynicism, you can see in his eyes that he's like wanting to believe it with her. And so that's where kind of like that in that sequence specifically, where you can really start to see the picture shift a little bit in terms of his character.
I think his turning point is the minute he jumps in after her in San Francisco Bay. He's fully, he is, you know, he's doven in.
Which, I mean, you gotta give Judy some props there, man. She's just going for it. That is commitment.
Well, he brings that up in the last scene. I bet you're a wonderful swimmer, aren't you?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I didn't even mention that with the bell tower either, though. Just like, because that's like, you know, what I said about him being calculating in this movie, that's kind of where we get to see, like, you know, vintage Jimmy Stewart there, where he's just, you know, got the mad eyes and he's starting that cadence of, you know, his voice generally starting to raise a little bit and stuff. And that's that. Ugh, man, he's so freaking good. I remember when I told you about the Mr. Smith, I was watching Last Week Tonight with John Oliver. He was doing a whole segment on the filibuster showing that clip. And at the end of it, you know, he's like, we watched this great sequence from Jimmy Stewart. And then he comes back from the clip and John Oliver's just like, he was a terrible actor. And, you know, saying it so sarcastically. That's what you need, guys.
So funny. Yeah, before we get to that the hotel scene, though, the other scene that always stands out to me is the surrealness of his nightmare before he gets put in the and another hero of the movie, Saul Bass, who did all of those did all those artist renderings and like the swirling logos and everything. It's that's another thing that you don't see in any other Hitchcock movie, something so surreal like that.
Yeah.
He really went for it with that sequence.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
That's if I've got a criticism of the film, that's one of the things that probably has aged the least well.
Yeah.
You know, and it's not even that we've now got computer technology that you can basically do anything with. It's just that they're pretty simplistic in their design. They're effective that way too.
Yeah.
But the you know. In 1958, you know, animation was doing some amazing things. If you look at what the Disney studios and things like that were doing, so it's a little jarring in the 2019 perspective when you get those coming in, and especially the spinning Jimmy Stewart head coming in.
What are you talking about, man? Yeah, that hasn't aged quite well. Kudos for Stewart for being willing to do that, though, man. You know, you can think most actresses' caliber might have been like,
I don't think he had a choice, though.
Yeah, exactly.
He knew what he had signed up for.
Yeah, so and Jeremy, as you mentioned, though, really everything in the movie kind of, you know, with the final sequence aside, everything kind of leads up to that moment in the hotel room once everything has totally come full circle.
Yep.
And, you know, essays have been written about that scene and so many different takes on it and everything. It's just you can watch that scene I don't know how many times and get something new out of it, you know, because you feel the pain of both of them. You feel he's finally settled into his obsession and he's starting to enjoy it now. Mm-hmm. I mean there's so many different things going on.
Oh yeah, there's torturous rapture. Yeah. There's resigned pain. There's so many different emotions going on between just two individuals in this sequence. But I mean, like, Eric, I know you probably have something to say about the green that's used in this and that hazy green dreamlike stuff.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, that again is, so first of all, the green comes from this sort of horrible neon sign.
Yeah, it's supposed to represent that
window. Mm-hmm. But it just floods into the room, and when she comes out of the bathroom looking 100% like Madeline, and there's a foggy haze, it's her moment of rebirth.
Yeah.
You know, it's her. Judy's now dead. Madeline is the only one that exists. And so then, just as you said, there's Scotty can now enjoy the fruits of his labors here. Mm. The obsession that he's been working on so hard is now in front of him. But that shot of her coming out, and initially it's kind of hazy. You're not sure if she's actually going to look like Madeline. And then she sort of steps forward and the picture comes back into focus. You could write an essay just on that 3 seconds of film right there.
Yeah, absolutely. And I always love the juxtaposition of these two characters in this moment, because you're right, like, Scotty is just finally in just this almost rapturous state here about, I love how you put it there, finally being able to enjoy the fruits of his labor. Like, you know, he's been so obsessed, so painstakingly detailed in how to make her into Madeline, and now he can finally enjoy that. But conversely, this is also, I think, where Judy finally understands what her enabling has wrought, and that, you know, there's just a painful resignation, I think, with her in this scene, where she knows this is the only way she's keeping him now. This is her life now. And even though I think she's willing to do it, I don't think she was prepared for how painful this particular moment was going to be. And it's all over Kim Novak's face.
Yeah. I love, and just, you know, it's so amazing the way that Hitchcock, you know, pans around, you know, and does sort of this 360 around them. And then once he gets to that one side, you start seeing, you know, that there's a design of the Spanish mission behind them. And it's almost like the past and the present and reality and fantasy are all kind of converging, and Jimmy Stewart can't make heads or tails of what is what anymore.
Right.
He just knows that everything has just finally come full circle, and this is the moment that he's finally waited for.
I mean, and you just said it there, the camera spins, it comes full circle. It's vertigo. I mean, that's the absolute apex right there.
Yeah. It's just this swirl of emotions, like, you know, and I don't know about you guys, but I don't know who to sympathize with in that scene, you know, because again, it's not like Judy is a wholly sympathetic character here. I mean, I guess I'm supposed to, because she's the one who's been objectified to the point of no return here by Scotty. But at the same time, you'd be hard pressed to say she doesn't kind of deserve some kind of strife for her role in killing Gavin's wife. But it's also just, I can't find myself rooting for Scotty there, because you can see how unhealthy this is and how you don't want to give into that kind of thinking as well in any way. So, I mean, it's such a conflicting thing for the viewer too, about what to think about this scene.
Yeah. Because for me, I was rooting for, well, they're flawed characters, but there's a piece of me that says, well, sure, all of us are. So can I root for just the love that they've got there? Mm. And so I found myself sort of doing that. And then it quickly breaks away from that too. And you see, the minute that she's got relief and she relaxes, and then she makes that fatal mistake.
Yeah.
And he has a completely different reaction. And it's that whole sequence there is just amazing as well. And Jeremy, I think you said it before, that absolutely breaks him. And he just, he becomes more manic as the film goes on from that point.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And somehow though, you know, it's, you know, and it's alluded to at the beginning of the movie, you know, another, you know, sort of psychological breakdown can cure you of whatever ails you. I mean, you know, that's certainly
psychotic breaks.
It takes a lot to get him there, but that vertigo is cured by the end of the movie.
What a 1958 take on psychology there.
Yeah. I think they have medications now. No need to climb clock towers and, you know, facilitate deaths.
Yeah, before we get now to sort of the release of the movie and reactions, any other thoughts about the actual meat of the movie before we move on?
I don't know. I think we got it. I think we got most of it there.
It's really, I mean, and all that we've been talking about sort of symbolizes why the movie didn't necessarily do all that well when it was released.
I'm gonna guess this was the one that aged pretty well.
It broke even when it came out and did all right. It wasn't not nearly the blockbuster that other Hitchcock movies had been. Reviews were mixed, and really Hitchcock took the disappointment of this movie incredibly personally, and he had to find people to blame. So he blamed Jimmy Stewart for looking too old in the movie. He said, you know, no one believed that an older Jimmy Stewart with, you know, a young Kim Novak. And so that's sort of what he sort of just, you know, claimed it to be. And of course, never cast Jimmy Stewart in anything again.
I'll say he realized he had control over that, right?
But, you know, you're not dealing with a rational.
No.
But like I said, over time, though, you know, and it's amazing. Movie not nominated for a single Oscar.
That's stupid, man.
So it's, you know, but the Oscars usually make questionable decisions. So.
Sure. Yeah, also. So you would think that, like, even just, like, they would throw Bernard Herrmann a bone or something like that, you know?
Yeah, for, you know, Hitchcock movies were not the awards fodder that they've become in recent years. They were considered movies more for the masses back then.
Yeah, right.
So
yeah, because, kinda, like, if people don't know, I mean, he never won a Best Director Oscar, so...
No, he did have a movie that won Best Picture. Rebecca did. but that was a David O. Selznick production. So Selznick got the Oscar.
Sure,
but
because of how the narrative in this one is sort of nonlinear though, and it's so dense.
Yeah.
With so many different meanings, it's really not surprising to me that the audiences that had come to expect a suspense thriller from Alfred Hitchcock didn't respond that way to this one. And then, Brandon, you said he took it personal. Yeah. He had to have. This is the most personal Hitchcock film, in my opinion. I mean, he threw a lot of himself into this one.
Yeah. Well, then once this movie's over, he turns around and the next movie he makes is North by Northwest, which is a complete 180, and it's a huge blockbuster. Yeah.
Back to the old formula, though.
Back to the comedy suspense formula.
And he casts Cary Grant, who's the same age as Jimmy Stewart, with Eva Marie
playing against Eva Marie Saint. So, yeah, good. Well, you learned your lesson there. So.
Could you see a Cary Grant in Vertigo? I mean, he's a great actor.
I think he's too charming. He's too charming. Yeah. He's too naturally charming, you know, because like in North by Northwest, you know, there's some tense moments there, but it's all also built upon kind of that, like, laugh in the face of danger, James Bondy type stuff.
He's, you know? He's got an answer for it. Exactly. Yeah. He doesn't have the vulnerability.
Yeah. And the interesting thing about this movie though, is it took a while for people to really see the value in it. And it was one of five Hitchcock movies that were taken out of circulation because there was a copyright issue. So from 1973 to 1983, you didn't see Vertigo and you didn't see Rear Window or The Man Who Knew Too Much or The Trouble with Harry. So, and then finally in 1983, they were re-released again in theaters, and all of a sudden people saw Vertigo for what it was, and it was, you know, wow, we really missed out on something.
This is kind of like a pseudo Blade Runner situation then. It really kind of is, you know, because Blade Runner was seen as like kind of a niche thing when it first came out, then it got re-released and everybody's like, ooh, look at Ridley Scott here. And you know,
Yeah, but then you have the arguments of the cuts of the director's cut.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. That's a whole different podcast.
Yeah, now yeah. we don't need that on this one because, you know, yeah. Oh, you know what, Brandon, we should talk Blade Runner because of Rutger Hauer, man. No, but I agree with you, though. It's like, do you think that, like, that absence, again, kind of made people, you know, what, the heart grow fonder type thing, you know?
Yeah, I don't know. And there's something about Vertigo that just – and it ages better than almost any movie because I was looking when the American Film Institute in 1998 did their first 100 list. It was 61. 10 years later when they did the other list, it jumped from 61 to number 9.
Yeah.
So
– yeah, I remember that.
So, and then it was then it was 2012 – one of the other popular magazines, Cinema and Scene or something like that, named it the number one movie. It surplanted
Unseated Citizen Kane.
Citizen Kane.
Yeah. So there's something about it that's just modern.
Yeah. Well, go ahead, Eric.
I was going to say maybe it represents a changing tastes in, or maybe. A sort of diverging tastes in American film audiences. Mm-hmm. And you have now moviegoers versus film buffs and people who seek out film. And this now falls into more of a and because it plays more like a foreign film, more of an achievement than some of the other things that are more blockbustery type movies.
That's a good point, Eric, because as generations of critics, you know, mature, the tastes get so much different. You're absolutely right. I mean, my tastes are way different than they were when I was 16, seeing the Wild Wild West podcast I recorded. But also I think that there's a universalness in this because look, like Hitchcock was always very good at like putting stark emotions in like personifications of real people, you know? And I think that's why his movies last so much, you know, he put like kind of universal, emotions and themes and kind of really personified them in just one person at one time. And that makes it so that we can really imprint ourselves no matter what time frame his movies are set in. You know, we can always put ourselves in there. We can all identify with something breaking us mentally, you know, with something being overwhelming or being obsessed with something. And we can, you know, no matter when we're watching this in what decade, we can see ourselves in Scotty, even if it's in a surreal sort of way.
Yeah,
there really is, and you said it, Eric. Aside from the nightmare scene, there's something really timeless about the look of the movie. It's not, you can clearly see, you know, in terms of the cars and the clothing. Yes, it's 1958, but it's so heightened. It's not really of its time. It's very much sort of its own universe.
Sure.
And I think that's kind of what keeps it. That's what keeps it fresh, also. And just I think the performances of Jimmy Stewart and Kim Novak are still modern. I think you could put them in a modern movie today and they would still work.
Oh, I agree.
Yeah.
I agree. So who would play it today, guys?
Oh, gee.
Who's going to play it in the inevitable Jerry Bruckheimer remake?
Do you want the choices that will be made or the ones that should be made? Because they're pretty different.
Oh, man.
I'm not going to call out specific actors and actresses, but yeah, leave this one alone. Let's leave it alone.
Yeah, but like in a modern sense, like it takes somebody like an Adam Driver or a Tom Hardy or something like that to really kind of play that obsessiveness, you know.
Well,
yeah, I can see that.
Well, unless you want to go for what he did with Jimmy Stewart, the all-American guy being corrupted, you know, you could do it with
ten years ago, Tom Hanks.
That's what I was thinking.
Get a Tom Hanks in that role. But, that would be great.
But,
you know, and I could see a Jennifer Lawrence stepping into
definitely.
It.
Oh, definitely.
Yeah.
Definitely. She's got Hitchcock absolutely. Leading lady written all over her.
Oh, yeah.
She does. She absolutely does. Yeah. So as we start to wrap things up, in terms of your own personal – in terms of your own personal taste of Hitchcock, where does this fall in terms of the Hitchcock canon, Eric?
Boy, that's a tough one because Rear Window for me is a top five movie. Mm-hmm. This is close though.
Yeah.
And before we were talking about this, I think I told Jeremy I got this movie immediately after they re-released it on VHS, and I think I wore that thing out in the mid-90s. So for me, this has got to be top two Hitchcock in top 10 all time.
Yeah. Jeremy?
That's pretty close to mine too, because you're right. Like, it's not as universally watchable as a Psycho, as a Rear Window, as a North by Northwest. But I think it definitely has to be the class of his filmmaking. You know, like, I think this is Hitchcock at his filmmaking best. It might not be his most suspenseful. It might not be his best horror. It might not be, like I said, the most easily watchable. But I think this is him at the top of his directing craft. And I think for that reason, you have to say it's the best that Hitchcock ever did. My personal list, yeah, I'd put it in like the top three, I think. Like I said, I'd probably more readily watch Psycho and Rear Window. But this one, I think, is definitely his best work. And yeah, we haven't gotten there quite in our list yet, Brandon, but this will probably be making a top 10 appearance in my top 100 films.
Yeah, it's, yeah, I mean, it's like I said, it's not... It's very much toward the top of my list, but if it was like a snowy Sunday afternoon, I'd probably kick back and stick in North by Northwest or Man Who Knew Too Much or something like that.
Sure.
But yeah, Vertigo, it's in terms of filmdom, you know, just hard to top. I mean, I don't think there's, you can't really pin, like I said, you can't pinpoint it to a genre. I don't think there's been a movie made like it.
No.
Really. I mean, there might have been some movies that attempted to try, but none that succeeded. So yeah, very, very rare. And you're right, Eric. I don't think anybody should touch it.
Nope. Leave it alone, Jerry Bruckheimer. I just assume.
Yeah. Yeah. So as we start to wrap up, just final thoughts on Vertigo. Jeremy?
Yeah, I mean, this has been a wonderful discussion, guys. And I think it's because... You know, we have a movie here that is really, when you come down to it, about the fragility of the human state, you know, and about how we can so easily give in to our obsessions and give in to our vices. And the fact that all of these convergences happened at the right time, Jimmy Stewart at the right time, you know, getting him at the right time in his career, Kim Novak at the right time in her career and life too, and getting Alfred Hitchcock, I think, at the right time in his career. I think this is one of those singular movies where cinema, everything in the cinema firmament, like, kind of aligned, you know, and we get this gem of a movie because of it. So yes, if you haven't seen Vertigo, just do yourself a treat. I mean, it's not like an overtly long movie. It moves at a good clip, and it's just well worth the watch.
Yeah. Eric?
Yeah, I would echo that. This movie does the thing that movies, I think, should do. It speaks to all those different parts of us that make us human, and it does it really, really well. If you haven't seen it, go see it. And do this, talk about it with somebody else. That's what this movie really does too, is it opens up the conversations of, you know, here's what I believe, here's what I think, here's how I feel. And it does all of those things. And to me, that's what movies should do time in and time out. So this could be part one of three of these two. This movie's got so many different things going on as well that we couldn't even touch on all of them in just this short amount of time. But great movie. I'd recommend it.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I should have done a, you know, even though it's a 60-year-old movie, you know, if you have not seen this movie, I don't know why you listened to us for this last hour. But
we already determined 10 years is the spoiler list, okay?
But this movie has got some major spoilers in it, but yeah. So it's better to have, you know, watched it without listening to us, but still.
In good fashion, I think I'm the one who gave it away first, so, you know, filling my front row role there.
As I said before, it's unique to the Hitchcock canon, which means it's incredibly unique in film history, because it's Like I said, never been anything like it. You think about it for days after you've seen it, because it's almost like, you know, in the same way that Madeline cast a spell on Scotty, Hitchcock cast a spell on all of us through this movie, because it's haunting. It's haunting. And it haunts you for a long time. So, yeah, absolutely. I would totally, you know, recommend this for anyone who is a movie lover. This is one of those must-sees. So as we come to the end of another edition of Front Row Classics, Jeremy, what do we have coming up down the pike?
Right. So another full packed month. If you haven't already, go and listen to the Pop Culture Draft Night from the Stephen King draft. That was a wonderful episode, of course, corresponding with the release of It Chapter 2, which I was on the Full Disclosure episode. Also, go back and check out the Full Disclosure for Once Upon a Time in Hollywood that came out, and also the Beyond the Mouse that you were just on, Brandon, on Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs with our good friend and artist Dominic Cellini. We've got a few special episodes. We've got some reports from Heroes and Villains Con and also the Comic-Con Wizard World Chicago that Craig and I were up at, where we got to interview George Wendt. Aren't you jealous, Brandon?
I know.
But also later this month, we've got a flashback, the return of flashbacks. They're going to be in honor of Rambo Last Blood. They're going to be looking at Rambo First Blood. So why not? And also, Guilty Pleasures is going to be doing the Chevy Chase, Jonathan Taylor Thomas classic Man of the House. And Brandon and Lou actually recorded a special episode on the 30th season of Survivor. Brandon, you want to give them a little preview?
Yeah, Lou and I just kind of about a year ago we were messaging each other, and we both realized that I'm not a huge reality TV person, but I have watched Survivor since its inception 20 years ago. Hard to believe, but you know, we said, you know, the 30th season is coming up, and he and I should do just a little palate cleanser, a little teaser for people who maybe have never watched it or stopped watching it years ago, to get them back into it. So that should be dropped pretty soon. So and it's fun.
Yeah, absolutely. So other than that, guys, again, so much stuff with the Front Row. Go to frnpod.com or nprillinois.org, where you can see all of our articles, all of our episodes, all of our feed exclusive stuff, you know, where you can only hear on those feeds. And then, of course, on Facebook, the Front Row Network, on Twitter at Front Row Reviews with a Z, or Instagram, the Front Row Network. Peace.
Absolutely. So next month, I haven't decided what the next classic will be, but it should probably be Halloween related. I got to think about it.
Spooky, man.
Yeah. So, but that'll be down the pike pretty soon. So thanks, Eric, for joining us. Hope you can join us again.
Oh, I would love to. This has been great. Thank you.
Awesome.
You are roped in, my boy. Yes. Yeah.
So for this edition of Front Row Classics, I'm Brandon.
I'm Jeremy.
And I'm Eric.
And we will see you in the front row.